This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, August 8th, 1998, the world's attention is on Nairobi, Kenya and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, where the day before, August 7th, which is the day we're actually talking about here, August 7th, a coordinated truck bomb explosion had rocked the U.S. embassies in those two East African countries. 224 people died in the blasts, including 12 Americans. More than 4,500 people were wounded. Fairly quickly, these bombings were linked to Al-Qaeda and most notably Osama bin Laden. Al-Qaeda and bin Laden were certainly on the intelligence community's radar, but I think it's safe to say less on the public's radar. And this was a notable moment in the rise of Al-Qaeda, which of course culminated in many ways in the attacks on the World Trade Center on 9/11. 3 years later. So here to discuss all of that context and the 1998 East African embassy bombings are, as always, Nicole Hammer of Columbia and Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
And our special guest for this episode is Karen Greenberg, one of my favorite writers and scholars on all things terrorism and security. She is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law and, among other things, host of the podcast Vital Interests. Karen, welcome to the show. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I will also plug your new book coming out soon. It's called Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. We will maybe see if that ties into this conversation as we go along here. But congrats on the new book. So, Karen, why these embassies in East Africa targeted by Al-Qaeda at this time?
You know, I think the significance of the East Africa bombings are you know, manifold, as you've described it. But it really is the emergence of bin Laden onto the scene, onto the international scene, in a way that the public noticed him, not just, as you said, the intelligence community. And they've been looking for a target for a while to understand how to make their case known, not just against the United States, but to do what bin Laden tried to do with Al-Qaeda, which was to make it an international presence and to make it clear that it had international aims, not just tied to the region itself. And so there were efforts throughout a number of places, including Sudan, to try to figure out where to ground Al-Qaeda, where to make their presence central. And we can talk about what happened after the bombings, but it's the embassy bombings, the response to the embassy bombings, and Al-Qaeda coming on the scene that eventually ended up with bin Laden and Al-Qaeda being in Afghanistan. Yeah. So to give you the bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, these were symbolic targets, right? They were symbols of U.S. presence in these countries, which is going to be at the core of bin Laden's critique of the United States. And there was this determination, as the memo says, to strike in the U.S., but that was a really, really difficult thing to do. And in the interim, there are going to be all of these strikes abroad, which I think is important because I think after the 1993 bombing at the World Trade Center and the trials that happen, I think Americans start to think about terrorism as something that happens against U.S. targets abroad. I think there's maybe a little bit of a loss of imagination of what it might look like to attack the U.S. at home. And I think that's one of the consequences of these bombings.
Yeah, it makes it all feel like, this could be something that happens either closer to home or even happens at home in ways that I don't think the American public was expecting. But also, I think it shows that in some ways, these federal agencies sort of underestimated the impact that these groups would have. And so it's not until after the damage is done that they decide to step up.
Yeah, and clearly didn't quite step up enough. 9/11 does happen, and it's this followed by the USS Cole bombing that a couple years later that makes it clear that, you know, Al-Qaeda is serious about its intentions against the United States. I just want to point out one other pivot point about this was that, you know, a lot of what bin Laden talked about was the U.S. presence in Saudi and, you know, getting and that he was really talking more about a military presence. And so by attacking the U.S. embassy, it's sort of a shift, right? Which we, you know, it's actually a very important shift because the move away from we're going to target U.S. interests, right? We're going to target U.S. presence and not just in a military sense, I think was actually an important threshold moment as well.
Oh, that's interesting. So that kind of situates this then in a sort of evolution, which culminates in attacking a purely civilian World Trade Center, right? A couple years later, we see this as maybe a progression towards, because that's sort of what I'm trying to get my head around with this story is how much was this a strategic target? This is obviously an embassy. It is not a quote unquote neutral target.
You know, if you look at the indictment for the embassy bombings, it's very interesting when you look at the names on it, right? Including bin Laden, you know, including Zawahiri. It really is what we come to know afterwards, and certainly after the 9/11 attacks, of people who are, you know, considered essential leaders in Al-Qaeda in one form or another. So it just in terms of what the American understanding of this was they did understand. They did do a deep dive in a way. The forensic analysis of this, the amount of FBI presence, time, energy, and money that went into FBI and other agencies that went into understanding what happened in East Africa was absolutely pivotal. And just to jump ahead for a second, when 9/11 happened, and people were like, what just happened? Who's Al-Qaeda? What? Yeah. The people in the country that knew the most about bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were the people who worked on the embassy bombings case. The prosecutors, the investigators, the intelligence agents, those were the go-to people who were there to explain it, which is, you know, sort of an interesting point, I think.
Yeah.
So I guess I have a question. So after the embassy bombing happens and the FBI sends like 900 agents to investigate, is that why so many, I guess is my question. And then was this a way for them to say, okay, this is how we're going to step up our game? Because it still feels like they're underestimating, and yet they're sending in so many people. I'm trying to reconcile that.
Well, I think that's a really good question, right? Well, they you know, they sent in a lot of people of a lot of different ilks, from cyber, you know, people who could work the cyber angle of this just in terms of communications, to people who might have, you know, known different parts of Africa to be able to talk about it. I think the sheer number says that they understood how behind the eight ball they were, how much they did have to learn. And the question really becomes what happens between that effort and 9/11, right? Why was, and a lot of that's internal, you know, within the executive, as we know, miscommunications, not wanting to let the threat of Al-Qaeda rise to the level of, you know, forcing the president to say we have to do something about this. So it wasn't, it was more, I think I buy the narrative that it was more for a lack of being able to get the message up the right channels in a timely fashion, even after Al-Qaeda, you know, they knew that there were threats that planes would be used to fly into buildings. I mean, you know, think about it. Yeah. So, so it was an internal, you know, interagency process. And you can tell by the way we responded as a country that's really how we thought of it.
But there were threats and there were people raising the alarm even before the embassy bombings. You know, I think some of the higher ups at the embassies were saying we should evacuate or we should move it, we should increase security. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we write the story of this era as one of increased intelligence but also missed intelligence, you know, what does this teach us?
You know, that's a really good question. It's always easier from hindsight. How did we know? How did we not know? I think with the embassy bombings, when you actually look at the granular level of what happened, you know, the intelligence failures of being understand, you know, what the purchase of these explosives were and who was in the network and how it played out, we missed it. But it's hard to just pinpoint, you know, a person, an agency, a moment, because the reason we're talking about this was it was a game changer. It was, here we are, we're Al-Qaeda. We issued a fatwa a couple of years ago declaring war against the United States, and we're serious. And we have the ability and the means to bring this about. And you know, it's not that the United States wasn't paying attention. It was that it wasn't paying attention enough and maybe not in the right ways.
I'm curious about what happens after that. There are trials in the United States of some of the people who organized the bombing and planned the bombing. You know, in the U.S. a few years later, there's going to be this criticism primarily from the right about a law enforcement approach to terrorism instead of a military approach to terrorism. And I was wondering, like, is there any criticism from within Al-Qaeda itself that the law enforcement approach is a sign of weakness in the U.S.? Like, is there any chatter about that?
You know, this is something I'm not... I have an inkling about, but I really don't know enough to answer. To me, what's interesting is the dialogue within the United States, because prior to, prior to 9/11, including the embassy bombings, which were, you know, devastating, there is a desire and an intent to use the courts to process these cases. And one of the reasons they're really important is the amount of detail they provide, and is the focusing on individuals and the way they build out the network. You know, trials are incredibly important for telling a story. And after 9/11, the United States moved away from that model. And, you know, it moved towards Guantanamo, it moved towards black sites, you know, things we don't have to talk about but necessarily today. But the abandonment of the court system to do this has been a loss in a lot of ways. And it may be the case that around the world, the court system is, you know, seen as a feeble as opposed to a military response. But that's all the more reason, I would argue, to do it. Now, I do want to say that, just to bring this out here, because it's very important, in addition to the original trial in which four were convicted, the very original trial, years later, one Guantanamo detainee, the only Guantanamo detainee that ever came to the United States for a trial, was brought to trial for these bombings on the idea that we'd already tried him once, we'll be able to try him again. And it was, I went to every day of that trial, and I can tell you, it was such a difficult trial. And it was Ahmed Gailani. He was in Tanzania. He was accused of helping procure the explosive materials for the bombing. And it was an amazing case for understanding just what you're kind of referring to. Can litigation, can prosecution, can trial address this? And the answer ultimately on the part of people who saw what happened in this trial, which is he was found guilty of one of 284 charges and acquitted on the murders, which we can talk about another time, sort of underscored backing away from using the trial system. So anyway, so that was sort of the end in terms of the criminal justice system for how we really think about the embassy bombings and what they signified.
I wonder too if you can just talk about like sort of public response, because I always have the feeling that Americans, one, don't get a lot of global or international news. You know, we're very sort of isolated and insular in the way that we think about things, especially political things. And that when we hear about something that's happening in Tanzania or in countries that we can't pronounce the name, or with leaders that we can't pronounce the name, we're quick to sort of dismiss either the gravity or the urgency of what is taking place. And then when something big happens close to home, it's like, what in the world? You know, I feel like that becomes the constant refrain of Americans, this not paying attention, and then all of a sudden feeling, you know, sort of duped about something that's been out there for a long time. Do you get this sense that it's the same, that the American public just wasn't not just aware, but didn't really care?
I think the unaware of the rest of the world point is really well taken. In terms of don't care, the question is for how long did they care or not care, and whose fault is that? I mean, if you look at the media today, there's so much going on in the world, and yet we don't hear about it on the major, you know, every day. We do a newsletter every morning, and I'm always shocked at the international global news and how come this isn't in the media. So I think that's a persistent thing that's not necessarily attached to terrorism or anything else. You know, I think it's not just the American public, though. I think you're making a very good point. The FBI going there, like what you talked about mm-hmm. before, you know, after 9/11, the FBI really expanded its presence globally, understanding that, okay, if the American public isn't going to be paying attention to this, you know, the American law enforcement and people who are going to be on the front lines against this have to pay attention to that. The intelligence and the efforts that start abroad can end up in the United States. So part of it was sort of understanding what globalization actually means in the in this century. And so I think there's a gap between the public and sort of officials who are tasked with this. And you want the officials tasked with this, at least it's, you know, to be paying attention globally. Yeah. But your point is really well taken.
It's also, I suppose, a reminder that now we look back at it and we say, oh, 1997 and oh, just or 1998 and just a few years later is 9/11. But, you know, 3-4 years is a long time. A lot of forgetting can happen, even institutionally, in 3-4 years. So it's a reminder of that. That said, you know, to this point of the FBI response, we should say this was the biggest sort of FBI mobilization in history up to that point. I mean, this was massive, as I think we're indicating. And I know this is a really sort of simplistic, hindsighty question, but Karen, I mean, how is it that you mount the biggest, you know, intelligence response in history, and then still a few years later have the biggest intelligence failure in history?
Okay, so part of it is because it was done secretly. Part of it's because there was an intent to avoid being known. Part of it was that the FBI and a big part of it was that the FBI and the CIA did not communicate about the hijackers who were in the United States. I mean, that is so, you know, we sort of know that part of it is that the national security briefing wasn't given at the highest levels on time. So there are all these things that come together. And, you know, it's just, as you're indicating, you know, it's so tragic that it was allowed to happen. But there's no one single vulnerability. There's a number of vulnerabilities, and they happened at every level: long term, middle term, and short term. Yeah. And so that's sort of what happened. Yeah.
It's interesting because I think we hear intelligence failure and we think a failure of intelligence gathering, but it seems like the much bigger problem is intelligence understanding. And communicating.
And intelligence sharing.
Communicating, yeah.
Right,
communicating.
And communicating, yeah.
So to that point, as we start to wrap up here, I mean, if we can take even a bigger step back and think about just, I mean, you're so good at thinking about intelligence, security, you know, how these things flow together. And, you know, maybe this is where your kind of new book and the sort of work you've been doing on security writ large lately ties in. But, you know, what lessons are there here from this 1998 bombing for how our intelligence community and the public at large thinks about security writ large?
You know, it's funny because my book might, it comes at a kind of a bleak angle to this, because what we're kind of saying
it's
is-
It's bleak stuff.
Yes, exactly.
It is,
because
it is.
What we're saying about 98 is that we didn't pay enough attention to it, right? We didn't put enough resources. We didn't make enough of it. What my book argues is that after 9/11, we did everything we could to abandon our norms, our laws, our institutional integrity, many things. And so I guess the lesson, if you wanted to tie it together, is not only do we have to play by the book and by the laws, but we have to do so in a way that tells the American people that too will protect them. And because 9/11 happened, they were able to say widely absorbed way and in a widely impactful way, they were able to say, you know what, we can't trust our norms, we can't trust our laws. And so that's where the really sad lesson, both of the 1998 bombings of the East Africa embassies and 9/11, come about. And what I argue in the book is that we haven't recovered. And until we recover on that level, we're going to be in trouble as a democracy.
Well, it's a heck of a kicker.
It's a lot. That's a lot.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, I suppose we should tell listeners we're also recording this at like the first thing we're doing in the morning. So there you go, Karen. Now our day is it is what it is.
I'm so sorry.
No, I just think that's so heavy, you know, in the sense that like because we abandoned these principles, you know, that is like the undoing of it, you know, that you think you have to take an extra step or you think you have to not be transparent in order for you to be effective. And that really is so much of the problem.
Oh my God, you said it exactly right. So vagueness, secrecy, institutional degradation, these are exactly the things. You'll like the part on secrecy. It's very good. It's a real problem. Anyway, so thank you so much for inviting me on.
Yeah, this has been great. So the book is coming soon. It is called Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. The podcast that Karen Greenberg hosts is Vital Interests, and she is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. Karen, thanks for all your work, and thanks for taking some time to chat with us today.
Thanks all of you guys so much. This was great. Thank you.
Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. You can get in touch with us with any questions or comments or ideas for the show. Email us thisdaypod@gmail.com, or you can find a form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
There was a bomb blaster on the back end of the embassy, I believe. I haven't got any numbers or names of anybody who had any injuries or casualties, but there were plenty of.
Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you'll need to join the millions of others who have switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Radiotopia.